From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, actress and model Isabella Rossellini. We'll talk about her celebrated parents, movie star Ingrid Bergman and director Roberto Rossellini, her years as a model for Lancôme Cosmetics, and her acting career. She starred in Blue Velvet, and she's now in the film Left Luggage, about the complex life of a child of Holocaust survivors. Also, TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at this year's Olympic coverage. Film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the re-release of the horror classic The Exorcist. And Mercedes McCambridge tells us how she created the voice of the devil for the film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson says the administration has decided to release 30 million barrels of oil from the nation's emergency stockpile in an effort to keep down the price of heating oil. The announcement came as Vice President Al Gore called for a release of the reserve oil, saying it will be needed in the coming weeks as the weather in some parts of the country grows colder. Gore's Republican rival for the presidency, George W. Bush, has denounced the plan, saying it's a political ploy and that the reserve is meant to cope with disruptions in supply, not high oil prices. As the leading industrial nations prepare for a meeting in Prague, their central banks intervene to support the sagging euro currency. The euro, which is used by 11 European nations, hit record lows this week. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Prague.
The extraordinary intervention on behalf of Europe's single currency, which has drastically dropped, was not expected before this weekend's G7 meeting. It caught markets by surprise and had the intended effect of boosting the euro. The intervention followed on the heels of controversial remarks by the IMF that it was time for central banks to move in and defend the currency that is supposed to embody a united and rich Europe. The euro will feature prominently on the agenda of the G7 when it convenes here Saturday. The spiraling price of oil is an urgent item as well. France is calling for a meeting with OPEC countries. In the U.S., President Clinton has decided to release strategic oil reserves while governments in Europe are scrambling to quiet a rising public storm over fuel costs. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Prague.
The Federal Communications Commission said today it's approaching a decision on the proposed merger between America Online and Time Warner. Meanwhile, the companies are trying to win approval from European authorities. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
FCC Chief William Kennard said his agency would rule on the mammoth merger within 30 days. That means the commission will decide around the same time as European regulators. That promise comes as the two companies have submitted a list of proposed concessions to the EU. According to reports, those concessions include an offer to cancel a joint venture between AOL and German media giant Bertelsmann. This move is designed to cut any link between Time Warner's EMI music company and Bertelsmann. AOL is also offering to make Time Warner Entertainment available to all other internet service providers, so AOL would not have a lock on the company's content. In the U.S., the company faces a possible requirement to open its cable wires to any one of this country's internet service providers, though U.S. officials say they have not yet decided what conditions they'll place on the merger. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow Industrials gained 81 points to close at 10,847 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 25 points to close at 3,803. This is NPR News. Ford Motor Company now says it will recommend that tires on its Explorer sport utility vehicles be inflated to 30 pounds per square inch. This week, Bridgestone Firestone executives said Ford may have contributed to fatal accidents by recommending a tire pressure that was too low. A plane chartered by French activists landed in Baghdad today, the first such flight from France since the UN imposed sanctions on Iraq a decade ago. Kate Seeley reports from Beirut.
The private plane carried more than 60 doctors, artists, and activists opposed to the air embargo. They flew to Baghdad despite objections from the United States and Britain that the flight may be in violation of UN sanctions. France informed the UN Sanctions Committee about the flight last night, but did not seek its approval. France claims the sanctions apply to commercial, not humanitarian, flights. Both the U.S. and Britain say UN permission is needed for all flights to Iraq. Last Sunday, Russia sent a plane to Baghdad that had UN permission, but also included oil executives interested in doing business in Iraq. The recent flights reflect growing international challenges to the 10-year-old sanctions, which both Russia and France say should be eased. For NPR News, I'm Kate Seeley in Beirut.
In a briefing to the UN Security Council today, Arms Inspector Hans Blix said the new disarmament agency for Iraq is ready to resume inspections if Baghdad ever grants permission. Blix heads the newly formed UN Monitoring Commission, which is ready to start preliminary inspection activities. Iraq has barred UN arms experts from the country since December of 1998. The inspections are designed to monitor Iraq's disarmament. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MuseumShop.com, an online boutique of products from museums around the world, including the Louvre in Paris and the British Museum in London. MuseumShop.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Isabella Rossellini knows she means different things to different people. She says to people 60 and over, she's the daughter of movie star Ingrid Bergman. To film scholars, she's the daughter of Italian director Roberto Rossellini. People in their 30s and 40s know her as the star of Blue Velvet. Women of different generations know her as the former model for Lancôme Cosmetics. I talk with her about those different facets of her life in 1997. Isabella Rossellini is now starring with Maximilian Schell in the new movie Left Luggage. When Isabella Rossellini was growing up, her mother was virtually exiled from Hollywood. Ingrid Bergman had fallen in love with Roberto Rossellini while she was married to another man. She'd filed for divorce, and while she was waiting for it to come through, she became pregnant with a son conceived with Rossellini. This caused a great scandal. I asked Isabella Rossellini if she understood why this turned her mother into an outcast in Hollywood.
Well, were you still doing it in America? It's pretty scandalous to me that people are persecuted. Politicians, military people are persecuted on the basis that my mother was persecuted 50 years ago. And often in interviews, people say it's inconceivable nowadays to think what has happened to my mother. It's happening every day. People's lives are ruined because they fell in love with someone else when they were married, or they had an affair years before. You know, all human mistakes that everybody could make.
This is a very good point. How did your mother describe to you the morals charges against her, you know, in Hollywood? You know, what people held against her. Did she explain that to you when you were young?
Well, she never said, I got to tell you something. We sat at the table and she announced it to me. She wrote an autobiography, and at the time that she was writing it, she went back to looking at some of the letter she had received and some of the article that came out, and I think that came back fresh in her memory. So in that time, we talked more about it. I think she was very hurt by it, and I think she remained hurt throughout her life, and a great fear of a witch hunt.
One of the things that I learned about from your new book, Some of Me, is that when you were young, you had scoliosis, a curvature of the spine, and yours was pretty severe.
Yes.
So you had surgery in which, 13 vertebrae were fused?
Exactly.
Do I have that right? And you were in a body cast for, about 6 months?
For about 2 years.
2 years, my goodness.
Yes.
How did you spend your time when you were in the body cast?
Well, most of the time you're very sick, so most of the time you just... you can't do much if you are in pain, you know, just sit there and wait till the pain subsides. And then occasionally I felt better, and then I tried as much as I could to go to school, take walks, have a regular life. But obviously it was incredibly disruptive. But I think the hardest part of it was the pain. The pain, everything else you could deal with. You know, I was a teenager and I was embarrassed to have a body cast. I was embarrassed to be labeled deformed, but because that's what a scoliosis is. But those all seem to be not major problem. Really, the great problem is great physical pain. That is really hard. And I don't have any solution for it. I'm glad that I'm over it.
How long did the pain last?
The pain lasts for periods, depending on the operation. And now they don't do that procedures anymore. if you have a scoliosis now, there you are either in a brace for until you're completely grown, or they operate. But now they've found a metal leak that they can use and the body doesn't reject. But at the time I did my operation, they used bone from my leg to fuse my vertebra so that there would be no problem of rejection. But in order for the bone to fuse together, I had to be immobilized for 6 months, and then also had cast. The operation was very painful. The stretching and the correction of the spine, which is now done while you're asleep and with these rods, metal rods, were done instead where you awake on a, and they literally stretched you like the medieval torture. And that was very painful. And that pain stayed for a long time because the cast was much bigger than I. So it would pressure. I had a machine in my mouth because the pressure was so strong beneath, underneath my chin and on my hips, that my teeth could go back in my jaws. So I had a machine to keep my jaw separated. But still the pressure on the jaw was great. So it took days before my body gave in to that length.
I think what's so interesting about what you went through when you were young is that, you know, you, as an adult, you've been an internationally acclaimed beauty. And it must have been so odd for you to go from thinking of yourself as deformed to thinking of yourself as beautiful, or to realize other people thought of you as beautiful.
Yeah, that was kind of, it was wonderful. You know, I remember keep on sending postcards to my doctor saying, can you imagine? it was pretty wonderful to have overcome all the odds.
Was it important to you to be beautiful? Your mother was beautiful. You probably had a pretty insecure self-image when you were young because of the scoliosis and the surgery.
But not so much. You know, I think one thing is to do, I don't know, I can't really, I don't remember being young and wondering if I was beautiful or not beautiful and terribly concerned about that. I don't remember even in my old age being very concerned about it. I don't know if it is wisdom or if I'm spoiled. Maybe people did tell me, you look so pretty. So I thought, oh, well, then I don't have to worry about that. So I don't know. I don't remember it as being an obsession. When I had scoliosis, I didn't think of myself as ugly. I thought of myself as deformed, as having a deformed spine, which is different, you know, and trying to be well and trying to walk. I couldn't walk because I'd lost the ability to walk. The stake was so much higher than just look pretty.
Right, right. How did you start modeling?
I started modeling by chance. I was 28, and I used to work for the Italian television. I'm Italian originally, but I lived in New York. And I socially, I've met a wonderful photographer called Bruce Weber, who wanted to photograph me. And I thought, oh, that'd be fun, so I can maybe buy the issue of that magazine all done up and save it to show it to my grandchildren. I'll be an old bag and say, look, I looked pretty. I was photographed once. But then from Bruce's photo, I really literally had an overnight success. And within a month, I was in Richard Avedon's studio working basically every day, having covers. And my life completely changed. And I became a model and learned to love it.
You've been photographed by many great photographers. What are some of the different ways they get you to respond to the camera? Do you feel like you respond to the camera differently depending on who the photographer is?
Oh, definitely. There is a definitely style of posing. I have seen very, very beautiful girl who didn't have a great career, and somebody else who maybe was a little bit, they're always beautiful. The common denominator among models is they are beautiful, but some of them are odd-looking, or there is something strange and not classical beauty, and yet they have bigger careers just because there is an art in modeling. There is a know-how, and the style of posing also slightly changes with a different photographer. It can be more emphatic and artificial, or it can be real and real acting. And you learn that as you go along and do it.
Are there things that photographers would actually tell you to do or tell you to think about that would help?
Well, in my book, I give the example with Richard Avedon. He was the first one. See, I was terribly spoiled. My first experience was with Bruce Weber, followed by Richard Avedon, and they taught me. I think I couldn't have had a better school. I remember when I was posing, I thought I just had to be obedient and wear the clothes and make sure I wasn't going to wrinkle them up and mess them up. and I sat there and just obediently just wait for every instruction, turn a little bit left, turn a little bit right, look up, look down, and I just obeyed. And Avedon would just look at me and say, "What? Can you think of something?" And then when I thought of something, he'd say, "No, change your thought. I don't like what you're thinking." One day I said, "What is it saying? What is, he doesn't know what I'm thinking." So I went back to a thought I had, and he caught me immediately. He said, "No, no, I told you, I don't like what you're thinking. Change your thought." And I think you could, if you concentrate, there is something that emanates through you. And that's what the great photographer photographs. The fact that you're, you know, Diana Vreeland, I quote in my book saying, there is no beauty without emotion. And I think that that's what is the responsibility of a model. It isn't so much to look beautiful. That mostly is genetic. You know, you're born like that. But you have to show your emotions. And that's what makes a great photo.
Now, is this something you think about when you're making movies, too?
Yes, it is. That's why I always say that it isn't, you know, people always differentiate between the two jobs as being so categorically different, modeling and acting. And they are instead, there is a lot of it in common. What you don't have in common is that you don't have a dialogue when you're a model. You don't have to react to another actor. Sometimes you react to the photographer in the same way an actor would respond to the partner in front of. So, but you know, there are a lot of similarities in terms of the feeling that rises from within and changes your expression in your face, in your eyes. That is exactly the same for modeling and acting. But acting probably is a little bit more complex because a storytelling, there is an evolution of emotion that you have to have, and you have to do them in a certain order that people realize that from upset you get happy. And how do you get to from this to that? In modeling, you don't have to do the range, the arc. You just have to show the emotion right then and then. So it's probably simpler, but it is very similar.
My guest is Isabella Rossellini. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Isabella Rossellini is starring in a new movie called Left Luggage that opened today in New York. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with her. Now, I found it interesting, before you started modeling professionally, you say you wore very little makeup.
Yes, I still do.
Why?
I guess I grew up like that. You know, nobody in my family used much makeup. And then you use so much makeup when you work, you know, that partially is maybe that. And you have made up with such great makeup artist that you can never mimic the result of makeup done by these great professionals. I enjoy makeup. I mean, it's definitely a great tool for my work, not only as a model, but also as an actress. I often used makeup and clothes to create characters, whether it was Dorothy Valance in Blue Velvet, or maybe the most extreme, it was Perdita Durango in Wild at Heart, where I just had one scene, and I've used completely my ability of model and body appearance and body language to convey a character. And I think I did, because in one scene, I think people did have a precise idea who Perdita Durango was.
Once you started modeling for Lancôme, you had a contract that stipulated you had to wear makeup for public appearances.
Yes. Well, obviously, I think they're right. You know, you have to celebrate and support what you represent.
What else did the contract say?
Well, the contract, I think the oddest part of the contract is the moral stipulation, you know, that if I was involved in any scandal, they could get rid of me, which reminded me of the contract in the 40s that actors and actresses had with the studios. And they were similar that way. There were many, many similarities. The idea that a studio then or a company now, it works as a Pygmalion. They create you. So you have to obey to that image, to that persona that they have created. Even in modeling now, there is a greater liberalization. But when I signed the contract, which was almost, now it's almost 17 years ago, still the moral stipulation was still in.
Now, another stipulation that was in, I don't know if it's still in today in contracts, is that you weren't allowed to gain weight.
Oh, well, that's obvious, yes.
Right.
But that's obvious because you have to, they have to use your image and you become like a label. So you can't change too much. You also stipulated it. I couldn't change hair color or hairdo, or that I have at least to have their approval. And it's understandable. You have to create a certain continuity.
Did food become a big issue for you during those years?
No, it didn't, because I never was an anorexic model. I always said I was the fattest, shortest, oldest of the models. So I was pretty much my weight. I just watched not to become too fat, and that was it.
Now, with the morals clause, when you made Blue Velvet, and especially when you were nude in a scene in Blue Velvet, did Lancôme object to that? Blue Velvet's a very kinky, weird film.
Lancôme is a big entity. You know, it's many, many people. And some people were shocked by the film, as the general audience was, and some people loved the film, as some member of the general audience were too. So there was the same debate that was in the magazines and in the paper. It was within Lancôme. But I guess that the film was successful, and the film was recognized as an artistic film. And then Lancôme became quite pleased that I wasn't just... I think in a way, for me, having been an actress and having done other things that just Lancôme, helped me maintain my contract for 14 years. Generally, the model to have the big contract, you get a big salary, so you don't have to work if you don't want to work. But then the company gets tired of you. They look and they say, well, there's another girl that seems more appealing. And generally, they don't stay more than 3, 4, 5 years. But I loved my work, and I wanted to continue it. And I think, and I just did it. And I think it helped Lancôme. They kept them being interested on me, seeing many facets and other aspect of me.
What about having a child without being married? How did they react to that?
Well, they didn't like that so much. But then they had to live with it, because I'm tough, you know. I assert my freedom very strongly. So they understood that at the beginning.
You were how old when you lost the contract with Lancôme?
42.
And it was because of your age?
Yes, it was because of my age. I mean, it was a very long debate. You know, it didn't happen all of a sudden. There is, you know, and I feel bad that Lancôme is nowadays the one that has been accused of having not kept me, even if we had an enormously successful campaign. But the truth of the matter is that any fashion magazine or any film, any woman that he's represented as beautiful, appealing, it's between 16 and 32. So Lancôme actually did keep me until I was 42. And there was an enormous debate within the company whether to keep me or not, until they just succumbed to the tradition. And they... in spite of my protesting, but it's their freedom, and I guess freedom is more to be respected. So I do respect their choices. I do still think that we lost an opportunity to break a prejudice, because I do believe that it is a prejudice not to use older women to represent elegance.
On a real practical level, older women buy their share of cosmetics, and they want to see them displayed on somebody who is a mature woman, not someone in their 20s.
Well,
there's no way you're going to look like that.
Well, that is their point. The point is that when you do a campaign, you represent the dream in people. You do not represent the reality in people.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe that the dream of women is to stay young. So they take the symbol of youth. They take somebody who's not terribly young, because then you will feel terribly alienated. It's very interesting. You see, the people that do the cosmetic campaign, the big cosmetic campaign, are generally on their late 20s or early 30s. They're generally brunettes instead of blondes, because brunettes are more accessible and people can identify. But still, they have to be young enough to represent a sort of a dream and what you wish to be. My point with Lancôme is that the new generation of women, the biggest dream isn't to stay young, is to be independent, to be free, to be powerful, to do what you like to do, to assert yourself. But they considered that too avant-garde. It's not that they didn't recognize it. They said, yes, but we still think it's a minority of women that has those values, and that the biggest group of women dream to stay young. That's why plastic surgeons are so successful, right. I guess. So they had a valid point, and they're there to sell cream, not to do a social battle.
What was your mother, Ingrid Bergman's, attitude toward getting older, toward having wrinkles on her face? Did that bother her?
I don't remember ever discussing that with my mother, and I don't think she was very affected by it. But then one day I spoke to my stepfather, who said, oh, Mama, you know, she was kind of worried about that. And it surprised me, you know. Then I said, well, obviously, she must have been to a certain extent. She was an actress. She must have worked less. But I don't know that it was a great obsession. In my book, I imagine a conversation with my parents. Unfortunately, I lost both of them in my 20s. And if you want, I can read you some.
Sure.
I asked my mother, I'm asking my mother, you know, the Isabella, Mama, you were told you were beautiful. Mother, oh yes, many times. I felt a bit embarrassed about it. I never knew what to say and what to do. Then I found the answer when they said, Miss Bergman, you look so beautiful. I say, isn't it lucky? And felt that with that response, I had killed the subject and we could move on. And then it's me again. And when they stopped saying it and you were just told you looked old, and then how beautiful you had been, Mother. I wasn't told that to my face, but behind my back. Isabella, but whatever. But did it hurt you? Did you feel bad about getting older? And Mother said, why can I tell you? I didn't particularly like it, but the alternative, dying young, seemed a much worse destiny. That's what I made my mother answer.
So this is an imaginary conversation.
It's an imaginary conversation, but I think she would answer that.
Isabella Rossellini recorded in 1997 after the publication of her autobiography. She's starring in the new movie Left Luggage. It opened today in New York and opens in other cities in October. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com, and from M-Power Communications, offering integrated telephone and data services to small and mid-sized businesses. Information available at nowyouhavethepower.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Isabella Rossellini talks about her role in Blue Velvet. Henry Sheehan reviews the horror classic The Exorcist. It's been re-released with restored footage. We talked to Mercedes McCambridge, who did the voice of the devil for the film. And David Bianculli reviews TV coverage of the Olympics. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1997 interview with actress and model Isabella Rossellini. She's in the new film Left Luggage. Rossellini grew up in Rome and Paris and moved to New York at the age of 19. She didn't become a model until she was 28, and it was only after she established herself as a model that she started making movies. How much of an emphasis on acting have you wanted to have in your career?
I guess when I was a teenager, I wanted to do something different than acting, because not only my mother was such a great established actress and adored, but everybody else in my family was very successful, including my father, was a great filmmaker. And then when I became a model, I thought there must have been some similarities with acting, and I became curious about acting. I kind of loved modeling unexpectedly, because I thought, like everybody else, that it was a stupid job. I had this stereotype in my head. So then I tentatively started to take classes and then got some parts and had the courage to do them, which isn't easy when you come from a family that has been so glorified in films. I like acting, but I think I like it somewhat less than my mother. My mother just adored it, lived for it. And I don't. I like it. I like it a lot, but I don't have the same. I think my mother liked acting most and above all.
I want to ask you about Blue Velvet. You are so wonderful in that film.
Thank you.
You played a nightclub singer who's exotic and mesmerizing, but is in a weird and abusive relationship with a psycho played by Dennis Hopper.
Yes.
How did you get the part, and what interested you in this part?
To me, it was the only time that I could portray a battered woman and a Stockholm syndrome, where it's very hard for a victim to recognize that they're a victim. Generally, a victim feels guilty, and does anything to please the person who's torturing them. And it's an absolute strange twist that our mind gives us. And you know, it is a recognized syndrome on kidnapped people or raped victims. And I thought it was quite interesting to play that part, and that what appealed me for the role. It was a wonderful way to portray sexuality and the darkness of it. And I played a femme fatale that was femme fatale just because she was kind of beautiful and she was singing and she had the features of somebody beautiful, but yet she was completely destroyed inside. And that was a pretty good role, you know. Most of the time, the femme fatales are portrayed as women who know exactly what they want and completely. And sex is portrayed as something that you go out there and choose for yourself. Well, we know that the reality is often we just have to. It just happens to us, and then we don't know what to do with it, what to make of it.
I'd like to play an excerpt of a scene that you had with a young man played by Kyle MacLachlan. And then in this scene, he's trying to solve the mystery of who you are and who Frank, the Dennis Hopper character, is. In this scene, you're being very seductive. You're trying to seduce him.
Do you like the way I feel?
Yes.
Feel me.
Hit me! Hit me! Hit me!
Isabella Rossellini, did you understand why this character asks to be hit?
Yes, I do, because I once was beaten, and I remembered when I played that part, and I had to say that line, beat me, I said, why would this woman want to be beaten? And then I remember that the time that it happened to me that I was beaten, the first blow to my head, and you just see little stars, exactly like Donald Duck. And there was a sense of bewilderment, and you don't know where you are. But I wasn't panicked. I wasn't anything. I just was bewildered, a strange feeling. And I thought that this woman, who had so many torments in her mind, became the victim of the abuse that she because she was raped and beaten by the character of Dennis Hopper, so that when she did get the first blow, the first punch, she would see the star and her tormented thoughts could stop. And that's why she asked to be beaten.
Oh, what an interesting way of looking at it. Who beat you?
I don't want to give the details of all that. I don't want to start, you know, being oh, poor me, poor me. It happened, but I'm fine now.
Fine, okay. There's a scene in the movie where you're wandering around the street naked. Tell me about that scene and what you wanted your body to look at. It's not a vanity scene.
No, not at all. I mean, not at all. David Lynch told me that when he was a child, coming back from school, he saw a naked woman walking in the street. And instead of getting aroused or excited at that sight, he started to cry. It terrified him. And he wanted to convey the same terror. He wanted Dorothy to walk in the street of Wilmington, where we shot the film, naked, and convey the same sense of terror instead of the sense of sex appeal. And when he was talking to me, there was a photo of Nick Ott that I remembered. And it was a photo of a young girl in Vietnam. She has been a victim of Nepal attack, and her clothes have been completely torn off the body, and she has skin hanging, and she's completely naked, and she walks in the street with the arms outstretched, and it's such a helpless gesture. And I couldn't think of anything else that this absolute helpless gesture and walking like that. If I would have walked covering my breast or covering myself, it meant that Dorothy still had some sense of pride, still had something in her to protect her. That woman had to have lost everything, and so she had to walk completely exposed, just saying, help me. And that photo is the photo. I took the gesture from that photo and used it. And I hope that I conveyed the same sense of despair. I wanted to be like raw meat. You know, my nudity, it was like raw meat, like a butcher, like walking in a butcher and see a cow hanging, you know, a quarter of a cow hanging. That was the thing that I wanted to convey.
Seems to me you really have a very analytical approach to acting. No, I mean that you really kind of think it through on many levels.
Well, I do, you know, I don't know. I can't tell. But this is the way I do it. I don't know if it is more or less analytical than others.
When did you realize how much you look like your mother? And I don't know if you agree with everybody who says that you do, but I surely think
yes,
there's a really strong...
They said a lot, yes. I write it in my book about it, because I always thought, oh, people exaggerate, it's not true. They, you know. And then my mother noticed it. My mother saw me once on television when I was working as a journalist, and she said, you know, I see it I don't see it in life, but see it when you appeared on television. We move the same. It isn't only that we have similar features, but there is something in the voice and in the way we moved. And I said, no, mother, you're wrong. I don't think so. I think you're wrong. So I was the last one to be convinced. And then one day I walked into an antique shop, and there were beautiful things, tables and chairs and old mirrors. And I was walking, and a middle-aged woman came in, quite elegant, but she looked very reserved. So every time I walked toward her, you know, I discreetly walked the opposite way so I wouldn't disturb her, until I bumped into her. And as I was walking, though, I kept on saying, she reminds me of my mother. She reminds me of my mother. And then when I bumped into her, I looked up, and it was myself. I had not recognized. It was the reflection of me in the mirror. I had not recognized myself, because I didn't realize I'd grown so old. And then I said, but I did say to myself, she reminds me of my mother. And it was me. Right. So that's when I thought, well, people are right.
Isabella Rossellini recorded in 1997 after the publication of her autobiography. She's starring in the new movie Left Luggage. It opened today in New York and opens in other cities in October. Coming up, a review of the re-released version of The Exorcist and a talk with the voice of the devil, actress Mercedes McCambridge. This is Fresh Air. Does this music ring a bell? The 1973 horror film The Exorcist has been re-released and is back in theaters. The new print includes 11 minutes of restored footage. Henry Sheehan will review it in a few minutes. The film is about a 12-year-old girl who's possessed by the devil. When she speaks, it's sometimes the devil's voice we hear. That evil voice was done by actress Mercedes McCambridge. She won an Oscar for her screen debut in the 1949 film All the King's Men, played the villain in the 1954 Western Johnny Guitar, and played Rock Hudson's sister in Giant. She started her career as a radio actress and was a regular on radio's I Love a Mystery. In 1981, I asked Mercedes McCambridge how she created the voice of the devil.
The Exorcist demon is a radio performance in a film.
Yeah, yeah.
It's 100% radio. But I had such a great teacher in college that I can go now from what is a rather high and thin and reedy tone of what I am doing all the way without any effort whatsoever down to the absolute coarseness of what I'm doing. And on back up without any problem whatsoever. Young actors are doing themselves a great disservice by not using the voice as much as they should as the best possible tool for communication. Everybody talks about projection. The most difficult projection in the world is into this microphone. That's where the projection counts. The timbre has to be so much deeper than to use a voice full of stentorian tones in a theater reaching 5,000 people. That's nowhere near so difficult as coming down to the thing of trying to convey to someone, I love you. Do you know how much I love you? That's exciting. And it's all a funny little instrument inside us, with a lot of timpani going in muted sounds.
Let's get back to The Exorcist. How did you figure out what the right speech would be and the wheezing sound that you developed?
Yeah, well, the speech was nothing. You know, and I read, again, reread, some of Kazantzakis' things about Lucifer, and I wanted to cry as Lucifer cried, but it's very hard to... we taped them on with 8 different microphones, with the people in the control room at Warner Brothers in this most sophisticated sound studio, and they would have them at different levels, and the microphones open them to various degrees or non-degrees of acceptance. And in one place, I had to vomit. On the screen, you see the green vomit from the girl's mouth, the bile, and it comes out in a projectile kind of way. Well, what it is pea soup with cornflakes in it, to make the bumps of vomit. Now, I had to make that sound. And the way I finally did it, and it was only through stumbling and invention, again, you know, as Stanislavski says, you utilize it, I would have them bring me apples, sections of apple, and I would put a whole bunch of those mushy apples in my mouth, and then from a Dixie cup, I would put in 2 eggs that had been just broken into the cup, not mixed up, just the yolk lying there looking at you, 2 of those, and at a signal from the control room when the frame of the film, which I was watching on the big screen in the empty sound studio, when it came up to the point where the little girl with the pea soup and the cornflakes coming out of tubes that were built up from the back of her bed and then around the outside of her cheeks and then her cheeks covered with makeup with spouts in her mouth, I had to time that precisely to the frame by swallowing these sections of apple, which were to be the lumps, and then the eggs down to mid-gullet, and then forcing the diaphragm muscles, and then throwing it up on 8 microphones covered with a tarp. That's very hard. You have a hard time doing that. Again, Stanislavski says you can utilize anything that's ever happened to you. All my life I've wheezed, particularly when I was smoking, thank God. I don't know if I could play the demon in the same way now because I don't smoke anymore. But when I did, I wheezed a lot. And I didn't know how to get the breath of the demon across. And I wonder now if I can do it. Let's see, because my lungs have been cleared now of smoke for almost 3 years. So there isn't that awful bronchial hacking noise in there. but getting very close to the microphones, and it's hard to wheeze for any length of time. First of all, you have to wait until all of the air is out of the bellows of the lungs, and then you can maybe for a few seconds sustain it. But Blatty says in the book it had an unearthly sound, the devil's breathing, that could be heard through the open door. But if I get very close to the microphone, maybe I can do it. Well, that's very hard to do because you're gagging and you're forcing right down to the ultimate, the last breath that you have in your body. You do that for 5 or 10 minutes and you have to go lie down for a while and come back and do it again. Very exhausting.
There's a great story that you tell in your book that I'd love for you to tell us. Mm. It's about a radio drama you're doing with Boris Karloff, in which I guess he's a vampire and
of
he
course
sucks
he was
your
a
blood.
Vampire.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a great sound effect that I'd like you to tell us about.
We couldn't find anything. This gentleman, Boris Karloff, was the vampire who had broken my neck or would break my neck in the show and suck the blood. And he's standing on one side of the microphone going and everything, and I'm making anguished little noises on the other side, dying of the broken neck and the blood being sucked. But we couldn't find any sound that would really give the impression of the bones in the body or the neck breaking. And Tommy Horan, the sound man at NBC in Chicago, bought a whole sheaf, if that's the word, of spare ribs. And he had a cleaver, and he was pounding at these spare ribs, and they were flying off like pterodactyls' toenails into the corners of the studio. Just really awful. But it wasn't the sound that it should be. So then in one of the drawers of his utility table, he found some peppermint lifesavers. And he put a peppermint lifesaver, I wish I had one now, on end between his back teeth and got very close to his microphone, the sound microphone, and crunched. And you'd hear these little bits, these little flakes of peppermint lifesaver being disintegrated. And it sounded like every small bone in the neck was being split. It was just great. So he was over there doing that with his mastication, and I'm groaning, and Boris is going, oh, it was sensational. But it was just a lifesaver.
That's such a great story.
Yeah. In radio, we had them like that.
Mercedes McCambridge recorded in 1981. She did the voice of the devil in The Exorcist. The re-released version of the film, which is now in theaters, includes 11 minutes of restored footage. Film critic Henry Sheehan has these thoughts on how the film holds up after 27 years.
If a horror movie is going to be at all scary, someone involved in making it had to be really afraid of something. Otherwise, the movie inevitably lapses into mere shock and facetiousness. The Exorcist is full of shocks, but it's never intentionally facetious, though it is certainly campy. Director William Friedkin's crude technique, which is basically borrowed from carnival sideshows, looks cornier than ever. Ellen Burstyn's performance as the possessed girl's mother, which landed her an Oscar nomination, mostly involves nonstop screaming. Too many of the plot twists, not to mention simple matters of continuity, don't survive scrutiny. But William Peter Blatty, who authored the book and screenplay and produced the movie, clearly felt genuine fright at the idea of a demonically possessed 12-year-old girl. No doubt many audience screams were provoked by Dick Smith's special effects makeup and some viewer revulsion by the obscenities which poured out of young Linda Blair's mouth, though in the voice of middle-aged Mercedes McCambridge. But it's the transformation of the little girl into a hateful monster that is the fundamental source of terror here. When the movie opens, Blair's character has just turned 12 and is entering puberty. The gooey discharges, leaks, and eruptions that mark her possession are well in keeping with male perceptions of menstruation. Same with the bad temper that marks the early stages of her possession. And the obscene language and sexual desecration of sacred objects could not have seemed all that different from what kids were saying and doing at what was the height of the sexual revolution. Even the girl's mother doesn't recognize her daughter in her dawning physical maturity.
I'm telling you that that thing upstairs isn't my daughter. Now, I want you to tell me that you know for a fact that there's nothing wrong with my daughter except in her mind. You tell me you know for a fact that an exorcism wouldn't do any good. You tell me that!
Mom is giving up here, having failed to stem her daughter's reckless development. She hands off the ball to two professional fathers, priests, in fact. The younger priest, played by Jason Miller, has problems of his own over his mother's recent death. The devil tries to exploit that by, among other things, telling him that his deceased mom is enjoying non-procreative coitus in the underworld. But soon, Max von Sydow's older, grandfatherly priest makes an appearance, and the two men drive the sex-crazed demon from the girl. Linda Blair wasn't the only nymphette to burst upon the scene in 1973. Tatum O'Neill made a splash in Peter Bogdanovich's Paper Moon. That movie presented the lighter side of precocious little girls. The sweet-looking O'Neill was the daughter of a con man. Her innocent front was the practiced performance of a bunco artist, for in reality, she was a hard-boiled thief who could swear like a sailor. As horrible as Blair's character was, that's how adorable O'Neill's appeared. Blair and O'Neill paved the way for the ultimate in sexually charged juveniles, Brooke Shields. In 1978, a partially undressed 12-year-old Shields had her virginity auctioned off in Pretty Baby. It would be nice to say that these movies were liberating acknowledgments of girlish sexuality, and maybe they were in a way. But every single one of them was conceived and executed by men and expressed their fears and desires. It's significant that, no matter what the girls undergo in these films, by the closing fade-out they are restored to a state of innocence, as if the male filmmakers were reassuring themselves and the audience that fantasy over with, there was no harm done. Women, on the other hand, often found this a no-go territory. In 1976, French filmmaker Catherine Breillat had her frank study of adolescent sexuality, Une vraie jeune fille, banned. It had its North American premiere only 10 days ago at the Toronto Film Festival. This reinforces the perception that little girl fantasies have rules and orders set by men. Keeping this in mind, we can look again at The Exorcist and moan, the horror, the horror.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews TV coverage of the Olympics. This is Fresh Air. The second week of Olympic competition begins today. Many people have complained about the coverage provided by NBC. TV critic David Bianculli isn't as unhappy as most, but that's because of his high-tech secret weapon.
There are certain times when it pays to be a geek, or at least a TV critic, if that's not redundant. One of those times comes whenever the Olympic Games arrives, because that's when I can take full advantage of my arsenal of TV satellites. So while I've been watching the Olympic coverage from Sydney on NBC, and on cable sister stations CNBC and MSNBC, I've also been tuning by giant satellite dish to Canada, where I've been watching Canadian coverage from the CBC. It's live, it's varied, it's intelligent, and it's wonderful. The coverage on NBC, I realize, works under a different set of commercial constraints. Nothing, though, explains why NBC's coverage, totally tape-delayed with about half a day to put most of it together, is as annoying and jingoistic as it is. NBC claims it's shaping its primetime broadcast largely for the casual female viewer. If that's the case, all casual females should be terribly insulted. Clearly, NBC presumes that fans of these games have a short attention span, a very small vocabulary, and are easily manipulated, either by weepy features on athletes or misleading promises about what's coming next. Here's the way anchor Bob Costas opened up Wednesday night's coverage, for example.
Day six at the Sydney Games. Hi again, I'm Bob Costas. Ahead, the most anticipated race of the Olympics thus far, the men's 100 free, also American Jenny Thompson.
The inference was that NBC's coverage of the men's 100-meter freestyle swimming event was just around the corner. But that corner wasn't turned until 3.5 hours later. On the CBC, on the other hand, they run an on-air graphic telling viewers exactly when to expect what. And it's live. Those tearjerker features are another big part of NBC's problem. Not that athletes shouldn't be profiled, but the way NBC does it is positively lame. The features are as slow and dull as high school film strips. And because NBC knows the outcome of each contest before assembling its telecast, it almost never inserts a feature before a competition unless that person wins a medal. Besides, it seems so unfair. We're supposed to care about the profiled athlete because he or she has supportive parents at home, or has endured hardships, or has a strong personal reason to compete and win. Well, who doesn't? The fair way to do it would be to profile all 8 swimmers before they dive into their lanes and start to race. But that would make NBC's coverage even longer and duller, which is difficult to imagine. And worst of all on NBC is the mistaken attitude that presumes American viewers are interested only in American victories. Whenever anyone talks to me about the Olympics, this is what they complain about the most. They want to see and cheer and share in the glory of the best in the world, regardless of where in the world they come from. In the 60s and 70s, when ABC provided terrific coverage of the games, that network made sure to give athletes from other countries their fair share of dignity. Sure, American victories were great to watch, but I remember being touched several times by hearing an unfamiliar national anthem being played to salute that country's winner. Those moments don't happen much on NBC, and the telecast, like anyone who watches it, is poorer for it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup, with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, SaabUSA.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Love They Lost, Living with the Legacy of Our Parents' Divorce by Stephanie Stahl. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the perils of writing autobiographical fiction. We talk with David Levitt. His new semi-autobiographical novel is about a young writer and his writing teacher. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.